Well, you know, life is capricious and, you know, it's fragile and you never know what tomorrow may bring.
No, that's why you've got to...
Carpe diem.
Yes.
Well, that's a sober note. Maybe the intro will cheer us up a bit.
If it's as good as yours always are, I'm sure it will.
You are a creep.
Yeah.
You are
It's all right, Paddy. It's very nice of you. Thanks.
Nice creep, but you are a creep.
Well,
yes.
Funnily enough, I met a girl recently at a party.
Paddy, he's recording this. Go on, go on.
At a party, and she used the word, but she did soften the blow by saying, but you're quite good at it.
I've got the opening bit for the programme, so we might as well start now.
Hello, everyone. This is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barclay, welcoming you back to another edition of Football Ruined My Life. And this week, we're going to be talking about football in the northeast of England. Essentially, Newcastle United, Sunderland and Middlesbrough, although I can already hear the howls of outrage from supporters of Darlington, Gateshead and Blyth Spartan, and my favourite northeastern team, Bishop Auckland, which incidentally has an amazing new art gallery filled with 16th and 17th century paintings from Spain. It's a marvellous exhibition with paintings by El Greco and Velazquez and Sergio Ramos. Sergio Ramos's paintings are a little disappointing in comparison, I have to say. Now, when I was a lad, I used to read all seven of the sports books on the shelf of my little local library. One of them was written by a man called Arthur Appleton, and it was called Hotbed of Soccer.
Right.
And it was all about football in the North East. Why it was even in the library in Prestwich, a suburb of North Manchester, is a mystery, but it instilled in me from an early age a love of the area and a respect for its football teams. But John, how accurate was that title? Is there anything special about football in the North East?
Well, you mentioned it. You forgot other sides, didn't you? Gateshead, who were known for a period as South Shields, and they're not known as South Shields. They were thrown out of the league in 1960. They were voted off under the old system, not relegated. Although they were bottom, it was the first time they'd ever had to seek what was under that system re-election. And they got voted out and Peterborough United came in. So Gateshead, as I've mentioned to you before, Mark Knopfler, the Dire Straits guitarist, said to me that his first ever game that he could remember really well was watching Gateshead play Crewe. So they were quite a big side and they disappeared. Hartlepool are, of course, now outside the league. Darlington have had a very, very strange history. They got taken over by George the Safecracker Reynolds, who at one point threatened to assassinate one of my agents over a player who wanted to move from his club.
It's different from the retain and transfer system.
No, but probably what gave George Reynolds the license to this was Jonathan Holmes is consistently over the years demands that something be done about agents. George just misinterpreted it.
Paddy, you must be aware of that football cliche, hotbed of soccer.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because of that title of that book, but it does seem to me to refer to the Northeast. But why would the Northeast be regarded as a hotbed of soccer where, I don't know, the East Midlands, to give John his due, would not?
If you have a hotbed of mining, you have a hotbed of soccer.
Good point.
You could compare it with the North Lanarkshire and Ayrshire coal-infused soil that produced all the Shankly brothers, Jock Stein, Matt Busby. You could stretch a point and bring in Alex Ferguson. Similarly, although the North East hasn't produced the same quality of managers, it has done in players. And again, it's just a coincidence that the former mining areas are hotbeds.
It's all working class areas. You see, it was mill workers, wasn't it, in Lancashire?
Yeah, I mean, where you get heavy industry, you get footballers.
I think a lot of players did come from that area. And, of course, Bishop Auckland, they won the Amateur Cup, famously under a guy called Don Hardesty.
Yeah.
Why was that area then such a big deal in the FA Amateur Cup? Because it was Blyth Spartans, Bishop Auckland, Spennymoor.
Yeah.
There were plenty of teams. It was like they were concentrated in that area.
And West Auckland won the first World Cup, the Lipton's Tea World Cup. I think it's fair to say that the North East never had a big rugby union tradition.
There was an extraordinary profusion of amateur teams in the northeast, as there was in like sort of Walthamstow Avenue and places like that down south. But you can understand it down south. Amateur sport, big deal. Amateur sport in something as unlikely as the working class northeast of England, Anybody got any ideas why that?
I don't know, but the assumption was always that they were amateurs and that they were professionals. I once asked a rugby league player, what's the difference between you and the rugby union players? Rugby union was amateur at the time, and he said, the difference is that we pay tax. I mean, Bob Paisley, for example, he came out of Bishop Auckland and fell under the wing of Matt Busby at Liverpool. And I remember the hardest, he was the captain, bald man, and seemed to dominate the amateur game in the way that maybe John Barnes and later Thierry Henry dominated the professional game in the country. In other words, he was the leading light of the scene.
And I know this is not necessarily a Northeast phenomenon, but I've never quite understood why the Amateur Cup, A, attracted 100,000 people to Wembley in the late 1950s when Bishop Auckland were the winners of the FA Amateur Cup on a number of occasions, and declined into nothingness within a few years. Mm. Anybody got any suggestions to why that might have happened?
Ceased to show it on television, didn't they?
Yes.
It was shown at one point on television. I can remember, I think, watching it on television, but the answer is I don't know. I suspect as more money came into the game and the maximum wage was abolished, the better players then went into the pro game quite quickly. Let's not forget, there wasn't a great deal of money in playing football. You were only slightly above working class wage in football early on. So I think that probably led to the death of prominence of it.
I would say that as late as 1958, one of the first phone calls received by Manchester United from the football community after the Munich disaster was from Bishop Auckland, who offered to lend them as many players as they wanted.
There was one player who did make that transition to United.
And played for England, which was Warren Bradley.
Warren Bradley, yes.
But there were other players who were lent so that United could fulfil their fixtures in the Reserve League. So Bishop Auckland were noble members of the football family as late as 58 and beyond.
To get back to the hotbed, of course, the phenomenon which we've all seen is despite the North East having these big clubs, Newcastle, who were very big during the 1930s and won the FA Cup three times, which was a bigger prize than the league in the 50s. They won in very short succession, a phenomenon not really repeated until we get to the current age. But Sunderland were known as the Bank of England club. Middlesbrough had one of the great players of the age in Wilf Mannion. They had the England captain, didn't they? The left back.
George Hardwick.
And even when they were in the second division, Middlesbrough had, was it Mick McNeil, who played left back as well in the England team? But they haven't been successful. It strikes me the North East has, more than other areas, been prone to succumbing to the cult of this messianic figure.
Yes.
Stan Seymour was this sort of man known as Newcastle United. He was a player. He then fell out spectacularly with the club just prior to the war. Then he came back as manager, director. He overruled the manager in 1955 who wanted to drop Jackie Milburn. And Seymour went on being a part of Newcastle, even though he's a very unsuccessful manager stroke director for a number of years, and then oversaw their sort of fall away from 1955. Mm-hmm. Sir John Hall was, again, this messianic figure. Kevin Keegan was, Malcolm McDonald was. They've always seemingly been searching for this figure. More than anywhere else, that has been the sort of thing that personifies to me Newcastle football when I was a boy and up to the current time. Yeah.
I mean, you could draw a comparison with Scotland, you know, the northeast neighbour, in that if you wanted to infuriate people either north or south of that border, you could say that, like Scotland, the northeast is more famous for producing fans than players.
More famous for producing journalists, Paddy, as well, some people would say.
I used to love going to the northeast because, well, there were two reasons. One, there was a real passion for the game, and you could talk into the night with these guys. You'd get people having their entire careers of 50, 55 years there. You mentioned Arthur Appleton, Colin, who wrote many valuable books. He was part of the fabric of Northeast football, as were other journalists. Doug Weatherall of the Mail would be one, but I could give you lots of others. And to be football correspondent of the Newcastle Chronicle, you know, you were a real celebrity around town, going to any pub, and you wouldn't feel lonely.
The thing about the pubs was, as well, I can remember when Steve Whitworth and Bob Lee,
yes,
both of them got transferred up, and they went up because I was arranging various bits and bobs for them. And we went out at night for a drink with a fellow called Big Jim Holton, who'd been transferred from Manchester United.
6'2", eyes of blue, Big Jim Holton's after you.
He was with me, which I thought was an advantage at that point. A most engaging fella, I might tell you.
A very sweet guy, and as I recall, brown eyes.
Yes. Anyway, we went into a pub, and every pub had discussions about the plight of Sunderland Football Club in it. It was a hotbed of football in that respect, and it was really the majorly topic of conversation and everything. And the wives of the players going up there from other parts of the country found it really, really difficult to settle there.
Yeah.
Well, because it was so different from what they've known elsewhere in the country, it was a very different...
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
Can I just say something about the Mackhams, about Sunderland? When I went up there, I was always quite surprised that, and we still do it now on Football Ruined My Life, we describe Newcastle as a one-club city, which it is, and enhanced by the positioning of St James Park like a cathedral on the top of a hill or an incline. But I don't think it is. I think you could argue equally that the Stadium of Light is only, what, 6-7 miles away from St James Park. And that derby is up with any. It's cost a few managers their jobs.
Yes.
Defeat in a Tyne Wear derby is probably, you know, the most painful thing a manager could have in such a football-mad community. And may I say a little bit about Sunderland? Because when starting out as a journalist, I was based in Manchester, so I would get quite a lot of North East games. And I remember going to Sunderland the first time. And although it was not a great stadium, that Roker roar was quite something. The crowd was about 17,000 the first game I saw. And you walked to the ground from the... There was a little hotel where we used to stay by the beach. And by the way, don't imagine Malibu when I say beach. But then you'd walk in. And when the teams came out, I'll never forget that Roker roar. I'm thinking, how did 17,000 people make that noise? But it was something special. So they lost something when they went to the Stadium of Light. But of course, they gained an audience because going to that stadium has definitely increased crowds and revenue.
Can I interject a note of personal reminiscence?
Yes.
There were two matches that, you know, have stayed with me, one for obvious reasons, one at Newcastle, one at Sunderland. The first one was at Newcastle, and you know, I'd become absolutely obsessed with Manchester City in the 67-68 season, and for the last game of the season was being played at Newcastle. Mm. Sunderland were at Manchester United and City were at Newcastle. Mm. We were ahead on goal average, as it then was, from United, so we had to match their result effectively. But we were away at Newcastle and they were at home at Sunderland, which they were expected to win quite comfortably. So it was not going to be straightforward by any means. And in the middle of a term when I should have been revising the dissolution of the monasteries, I seem to remember, I was actually hitchhiking from Cambridge to Newcastle. I didn't have the money to get there in any other conventional way. So I hitchhiked. I left about 9 o'clock in the morning from Cambridge and I got to Newcastle about five. Nowhere to stay, necessarily. And I don't know how I did this. It's completely mystery. Well, I'd found a place to stay overnight on the Friday. And then I was woken up by the smell of a brewery round the corner. It was very, very strong. I walked to the ground very early. I had nothing else to do. I met Eric Todd walking on the outside of St. James's Park. We had a wonderful conversation. He was my great hero, as you know.
Yeah, Manchester Guardian and then The Guardian. Yeah.
He was terrific and wearing a flat cap, I seem to remember, or something very appropriate. And this game, we had to win it. We were away at Newcastle. It was a difficult game. We went into a lead. They equalised. We got the lead back again. They equalised. 2-2 at half-time. 3-2, Neil Young immediately after the break. And then the goal that I'll always remember, which is Francis Lee breaking away, one-on-one, scoring, and standing on the wall behind the goal, surrounded by adoring City fans and so on. And that was 4-2. And then Newcastle came back again. They scored about 5 minutes from time. The last 5 minutes were terrible. But we were comforted by the news that United were amazingly getting beaten at Old Trafford by Sunderland.
Mm.
So Sunderland did us a great favour that day because it was very close. Mm. Could have easily dropped a point there. And Sunderland made sure it didn't really matter. So there was that. And then there was in 73-74, I think it was, City were drawn against Sunderland. We drew 2-2 at Main Road, and we went up to Roker for the replay on a horrible, you know, a classically nasty Tuesday or Wednesday night in Sunderland. And the Roker roar was exactly what Paddy described. It was intimidating. And that was the Sunderland side that won the cup, and they beat us 3-1, I think, on the night. And they beat us and beat us fairly, including Dave Watson and Dennis Stewart, mm-hmm. who we then signed, mm-hmm. who became good players. But I remember in both cases, Sunderland and Newcastle, the fans were fanatic, but not unpleasant and not violent. They were dedicated to their team. It created a terrific atmosphere in the ground, and we weren't good enough against Sunderland, though we were just good enough against Newcastle. And I have nothing but admiration for people in that part of the world. I think they know their football, and I was always very pleased to have been part of those two games.
That cup win of Sunderland's under Bob Stoko was one of the great stories, wasn't it? You know, they were languishing in the bottom half, I think, of the second division, as it was then. Stoko took over. He didn't appear to do much other than the fact they went on this extraordinary run. They had some good players at that point. I mean, they had Jimmy Montgomery and Dennis Stewart, as you say, Dave Watson. Jimmy Montgomery made one of the great saves, an amazing double save mm-hmm. from, I think, Peter Lorimer. And we all remember Bob Stoko running onto the pitch with his little pork pie hat on. Mm-hmm. But they never really cashed in on that, did they? They never moved on. No. And that's Sunderland's. I think that's their last triumph. Newcastle did win the First Cup in 69. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when John Hall took over, Keegan went first of all. There was the outburst against Alec Ferguson. You know, I'm going to really love that if we beat them and all this sort of thing. And then there was a later period with Bobby Robson, who went there, got them to second in the league as well. They are extremes of emotion connected with all the clubs up there that they do feel there's a right. You know, the fans deserve to win something.
Yeah.
They probably do. That's why, in a way, you know, the fact that they have had this money come in recently, currently it doesn't appear to be doing them that much good. They're not actually amongst the leaders of the Premier League. But I didn't particularly begrudge their fans who've suffered recently a little bit of success, because they do give enormous support. Mm. I went to a game about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago when we were doing quite well. We were about second or third in the league, and it was under Brendan Rodgers, and their crowd was really quiet. Mike Ashley was the chairman. He was a very, very unpopular chairman, as you know. But the crowd was really quiet, and I felt quite sad. It is an area that deserves success, but it proved that emotion alone can't drive you to the top. You do need a real solid ownership, which has a rationality about it. And you can talk about these messianic figures when they take over the club. You know, John Hall talked about the Geordie Nation.
Yes.
It's a little bit like Francis Lee taking over at Manchester City, Derek Dugan taking over at Wolves. These things always seem to end in tears.
Well, yes, but to be fair, the John Hall era also saw tremendous success in terms of winning football matches and influencing.
But not any trophies, Paddy.
No, that's true, but tell that to the crowds that pack the ground out every week. And also, I always think that the job of a football manager is to win football matches, not win trophies. Because trophies are often a matter of luck and chance, whereas actually finishing, you know, high up the league is actually greater. But I know in terms of romance, that's not true. And we've already spoken about the Bob Stoko final, the Jimmy Montgomery final. I'd like to ask everybody if they would agree with me that that was the last of the national event cup finals. The FA Cup final used to be a national event. You know, people who had no interest in football would take notice of it. And that was certainly the case with that one. You could argue Wigan Man City.
Southampton Manchester United.
Yeah, Southampton Manchester United. But rather like the Matthews final, although I don't think any FA Cup final ever surpassed that for national event status. But
well, that was the first televised one, Paddy. That's probably why.
That's probably why. But definitely that was true of the Stoko Cup final. We can all remember detail. We could probably name the team.
I think it was because the contrast between where Sunderland and Leeds United were all powerful.
Yeah, they were. They were one of the best teams in Europe.
Indeed.
They could have, you know, scraped it, but that they didn't was a wonderful thing.
I want to ask you, Paddy, about, you mentioned John Hall and that team, because I think that team, rather like the Sunderland team of 73, that was everybody's favourite team because they didn't like Manchester United. Mm-hmm. And everybody wanted Newcastle to win that mm-hmm. year, and they ought to have done. Mm-hmm. And they had this match against United, which turned out to be the one where it all swung, mm-hmm. where Newcastle battered United for 89 minutes. Mm. And Schmeichel kept them in the game, essentially. Mm. Shot after shot pouring onto the United goal. And then Cantona broke away. Cantona scored 1-0, 0-1. Mm. That was it. And the Championship went with it. After that, we had the Liverpool game where we saw Keegan slumped over the boards.
What I think needs to be recognised on a national basis about that Newcastle team, and you mentioned the first of the 4-3 classics, one of the best games ever seen in the Premier League. And I think Newcastle and Keegan and John Hall, by association, deserve credit for doing probably as much as any other club to create the image of the Premier League as an international entity which virtually guarantees you entertainment, far exceeding La Liga or Serie A or the Bundesliga, because of matches like Keegan produced, even though he didn't win them.
It was a team with a few foreign players. I mean, Philippe Albert, David Ginola, but not many. And it was Peter Beardsley is a real, you know, genuine northeasterner. I don't know if there are any others in that team, but it did have the feeling of representing Newcastle in a way that very few Premier Leagues represent the town in a way.
Waddle as well. These were incredibly popular guys. Keegan, the word populist is now used pejoratively almost entirely, but it was a fine piece of populism when Keegan at his inaugural press conference announced that his, I think his father or grandfather had been a Geordie miner. So Keegan would be up there, I suppose, with Jackie Milburn and Malcolm MacDonald wasn't a Geordie, but yeah. By God, they worshipped him.
Gascoigne, of course. We haven't mentioned Gascoigne, who sort of became a comic book Geordie, didn't he? Sadly, they do have this propensity to, it goes back to Huey Gallagher as well. Mm. I remember there was a time then, Freddie Fletcher, who was the managing director under John.
Nice fellow, Scottish.
Very nice fellow. Rang me and tried to convince me that in between Lineker leaving Tottenham and going to Japan, he could play for Newcastle, who was short of a hero at that point, and told me all the things that would, you know, ensue as a result. Arthur Cox had previously rung me when he was manager up at Newcastle and said, oh, Lineker should come up to the northeast, you know, he'd be a hero. They definitely worship their number nines, and that goes back to Huey Gallagher and Jackie Milburn. Middlesbrough is another we haven't talked about a great deal, but they've been owned for some time by a local hero, as it were, Steve Gibson. And for a time, Steve Gibson coming in, a local boy, made good in Middlesbrough, spent a lot of money, bought Brazilian players over there. Juninho famously played there.
Who was the bloke with silver hair?
Ravanelli,
that's the one.
Yeah. Middlesbrough, in those days, the skyline dominated by ICI. And I can remember one day looking across the estuary towards Middlesbrough, and the sky was all sorts of different shades, not entirely nice ones either. Yeah. And they said that Juninho, they never took him to Middlesbrough before they signed him. They took him somewhere in the Yorkshire Wolds and told him that this was where he was going to. But he lifted Middlesbrough a great deal. They got to two cup finals in a year. We beat them after a replay in the League Cup final, or the Coca-Cola Milk Carabao Rumbelows Cup, or whatever it was called at that point. And someone else then beat them in the FA Cup final as well. And their league run petered out a bit. And of course, in recent years, they've not been very successful, I'm afraid. Hartlepool now dropped out of the league entirely. Darlington got taken over by George the Safecracker. And their ground, they had a ground, was it Feetham's was their ground?
Yes, it was. It was shared with, you had to walk through a cricket ground to get to it.
Well, John, we know that Shearer was very keen to go back. We know that Manchester United were very keen to sign him when he was leaving Blackburn. And Ferguson was very keen to get hold of Shearer. And Shearer chose to go back home, as it were. Mm. Was it entirely an emotional decision?
I think he would say, yes, it was.
He does definitely say it was.
Yeah.
And he's very conscious of the idea. He has spoken about this, and I'm putting words in his mouth, but a little bit like Stephen Gerrard once said, you know, people said, you haven't won a title with Liverpool. He said, yes, I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth, and Shearer's. But what they felt was if you win a title for the club that's in your heart, it's worth five titles anywhere else.
I find that very encouraging. That identification of a player with a club that's so genuine and so 100%.
You know, Shearer's not a bullshitter. He's as far away from a bullshitter as you'll find, you'll find in football. And that's definitely his view, Colin. When I heard him talk like that and I looked at the fire in his eyes, you know, I understand that just because you're a footballer and you're very rich doesn't mean you haven't got the same feeling for a club as we have.
There's a modern example of this with Harry Kane, of course. Harry Kane was Spurs. I mean, never did any good on loan anywhere else, funny. I mean, he came to us and was really pretty poor. But with Spurs, it was a great awakening for him. And he became identified by the club. But, of course, he now has moved to Bayern and is doing spectacularly well. But that's later on. Will he go back there? Can you go back to somewhere and do well? I think that's always a difficult thing because the emotion can take on. I know Shearer was very disappointed that he wasn't given a longer chance to be manager at Newcastle.
No, he had about five games or something. It was ridiculous.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't very successful and they got relegated. Perhaps one would say you probably, when you're starting your managerial career, again, this is emotion taking over, you probably need to serve an apprenticeship at somewhere non-existent. Martin O'Neill, of course, who we've had on this podcast, was more successful elsewhere than at Nottingham Forest. Then when he went back to Nottingham Forest, it was a very short and unhappy spell.
I felt that very strongly when Keegan went back the second time to Newcastle as manager under Hall. That was exactly what John's just described. And you just felt he could never recreate the magic of that first spell as manager. I felt very sorry for everybody all round. It was just a disaster.
It's always sad when that happens. Francis Lee at Manchester City.
Well,
Dugan at Wolves. It was definitely in our heads at Leicester when Leicester had gone into administration and Gary and I were involved in the consortium. And he said, I'm not going to go back as chairman. That would be really, really silly. And people get deft ideas. I remember we went to a game one day and someone, a fan came up and said, go on, Gary, you should come back. We can be as big as Man United. And he looked at me and said, these people, they've no idea. No. We are, you know, we cannot do that. It's just impossible. And it's sad when people get carried away with that emotion. And I think the Northeast in particular is an extremely emotional place. People think about football probably more emotionally than anywhere else in the country.
I think that explains why that series, I think it was on Netflix, about Sunderland Till I Die, I think it was called, made by a company called Fullwell 73 after the cup win and Fullwell after one of the ends that people stood at. It was so good because it did tap into the community. It was not about a lot of players muttering to the manager in the dressing room. It was about the community and about Sunderland as a whole. And I just thought they got it absolutely right and your heart went out to them. You just wanted them to win and they managed to lose narrowly in playoff finals, having got there. And it showed the real people in the club, you know, the woman behind the coffee bar and the woman doing the kit washing and these sorts of people that you just wanted for them, for the club to be successful. But I also have the reverse feelings about Newcastle because I've really liked that club and the people since I read Arthur Appleton's book, Hotbed of Soccer. I have to say, because I feel strongly about Manchester City, it would be nonsensical for me not to say I feel equally strongly about Newcastle. If you wish to sup with the devil, you need a very long spoon. I know they're desperate for success, but they are in bed with a bunch of state murderers. And I just feel so strongly about it. It's one reason why I'm disillusioned. I don't wish them well. I wish them a return to the Newcastle that I've always admired, I suppose. And I hope they're successful, but this isn't the way, in my opinion.
That's, if anything, it's what this podcast is about. Football and its relationship with communities and what it meant to us when we were younger. Certainly in my case, it gave me a sense of being part of a community that stayed with me all my life. Although I've lived actually in the immediate environs of Leicester for less than half my life now. When I go to the city, I still feel more at home than I do when I go into Nottingham, where I've lived in or near for more than half my life. So, you know, it is there. And when you get taken over, because to achieve success at football means the club as a whole has got to be all aligned together. I think that it's rare for a club where there are boardroom rows and the manager falls out and doesn't get on with the director of football and all that sort of thing, for them to achieve success. Look at Everton. Nobody could have been a more committed fan than Bill Kenwright. But in the end, his life was destroyed almost. You know, he's advised by the police not to go. And Everton was a community club. Mm. You talk to a lot of Everton fans, you know, it's part of their life, part of their identity. They didn't have the hanger-on fans that Liverpool got for a period of time because they were successful and inevitably they got fans from all over the place. Everton never seemed to have that. They seemed to be, in a sense, more of a community club. And yet, in the end, it's crashed and burned because they were all falling out and they lost their identity with the community.
Yes, I think that's very true. But Paddy, you know my feelings. I'm very clear about this kind of foreign investment from nation states.
Well, I totally understand. I would be a liar if I said that as a neutral, I don't suspend my qualms while watching the team play and the crowd roar. And I'm very conscious that I'm maybe not doing the right thing, but I want them probably to beat Liverpool or whoever they're playing, you know, because I want them to do well. But I do totally accept what you've said completely about the ownership. And of course, they share that dodgy ownership with other clubs, including your own, if I may still call them your own club. But up to the First World War, Sunderland and Newcastle, between them, won 8 titles. 8! And that was over a third of the titles that were up for grabs. It's an extraordinary record. But of course, that was in the dim and distant. I would like to see them come back. Ideally, I wouldn't have liked it to happen this way. I would have liked, you talked about the Geordie Nation and John Hall's use of that phrase. I didn't feel cynical about that. I think what he was trying to create was an Athletic Bilbao or a Barcelona, a team based on regional identity. And I think it was a very, very good concept that we've got to this now. Yeah, I share your...
Well, I have so much respect for the Newcastle fans, apart from this compartmentalisation. My friend, my very good friend, Alan Gold, who's my dentist as well as my friend, fanatical Newcastle United supporter, he points out that the investment from the Saudi fund, whatever it is going to help certain areas at Newcastle that are desperately underfunded and undernourished, and the money will be used, as it has to an extent in East Manchester. Yeah. I understand that argument. I think you actually pay rates for this sort of thing to happen, income tax for this to happen. You don't have to go cap in hand to a terrible nation state full of murderous individuals to get housing better suited to areas of Newcastle. That's my point.
But before we leave that subject, I'd like to amplify a little about Middlesbrough, and that's to pass a mention also to Bob Murray, the long-term chairman of Sunderland, who had the club in his heart. And even more so maybe at Middlesbrough, you touched on it earlier, Steve Gibson is exactly the kind of owner we want every club to have. A fan, but no fool. You know, he might not leave Middlesbrough in the Premier League, to which he took them at one point, but his legacy will be very benign. And I don't even need to ask you for permission to say that he's what football ruined my life and all people of the same ethos want to have as chairman of their local club.
Correct. Mm. Now, I remember Jack Charlton, when he was manager of Middlesbrough, creating a side in his own image and in the image of Middlesbrough itself.
Yes.
And they had in their back four included people with the names of Boehm, which sounded like loam, and Craggs. They seemed to be made up of the constituent parts of a wall, which I thought was absolutely perfect for a football defence and indeed for one that came from Middlesbrough. I think Jack Charlton did a very good job there.
Many journalists remarked on that, and I wonder if it caused fury up in Teesside, where they said, well, these are perfectly normal names. What on earth are these southern ponces talking about? But you mentioned that team. It also included Graham Souness strutting around the midfield to magnificent effect. My favourite player in that team was the best uncapped centre-half I've ever seen in my life, along with Steve Bruce, a guy called Willie Madron, who was from Billingham, close by, and died at a tragically young age of 49. after playing just under 300 league appearances. And for me, he was the best centre-back in the country. And had he not been with a relatively unfashionable club, I'm sure he would have played for England many times.
You mentioned Billingham. Billingham used to get to the early rounds of the FA Cup. It was Billingham SR, which is something like Billingham Sinfonia.
Sinfonia with an F, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
The great titles they had.
Blythe Spartans as well. So there is an enormous diversity of clubs from up there who have contributed to the magic of the FA Cup as much as anybody else has. Yeah. You know, you, I think quite rightly, Paddy, say that was the last final that sort of captured the imagination of the nation. I would want to say it was 2021, of course.
No, it was when you won the title. That was a long-running national event, but it didn't capture everyone as the Stilco final did.
So full marks to the ITV director. I think it was ITV rather than the BBC, because at the end of the game, when Stoker rushes on, you make a decision, because you've got the bank of monitors in front of you. You tell the vision mixer which button to press to follow whichever picture you think is going to work best. And they stayed with Stoker on ITV, and that camera followed him all the way onto the field. And that's the dominant image that we now have in that silly pork pie hat, as John quite rightly says. We all wanted that to happen because Leeds were so unpopular and so good that this was the fairy tale that we all were desperate for, and Sunderland provided it that day. And good for them, and I hope they're back where they belong in the top league before too long, because that programme, Sunderland Till I Die, made me very conscious of how strong a community that North East was. But then the North East produces, is it Ashington, where the Charltons came from?
Yes.
And I think also Colin Bell came from around there as well. It does produce those fabulous players, and they lift that part of the country to a level which we all appreciate and like them.
Howard Kendall also came from that area, and his father was a miner. He was, of course, a tremendously successful manager, underrated in many ways, but not in his own area. He went to Everton, of course, as a player.
And Bob Paisley was another massively successful northeastern manager,
Well, John and Paddy, thank you very much to both of you, and of course always to our indefatigable producer, Paul Kobrak. It's been an interesting travel around the area, which I've enjoyed very much. So to everybody, thank you again for listening to our rabbiting on as we usually do. If you wish to get in touch with us, please write to us at footballruinmylife@gmail.com. And from the three of us and from Paul, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you all next time on Football Ruin My Life. Cheerio.
Marvellous.
That worked quite well, actually, didn't it?
It does seem to me to prove the chemistry between the three of us is so good that we don't really need the guest supporter of the club to add much. You know, I think we've had some good ones, but they're not mandatory by any means.
I'll cancel Michael Grade for next Monday, then.
No, don't do that.